Are you tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
Welcome back to the Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. Today, we welcome back a good Soapbox friend, David Swanson. David is an author and a peace activist, and he will be publishing the second edition of War is a Lie, and we'll be chatting about that. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back with David Swanson.
David Swanson, welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Great to be here. Thanks, Cindy.
Well, it's been a while since we spoke, so it's nice to have you on, and my listeners and fans of the Soapbox are very familiar with David Swanson, what you do, and your work, and your activism. So let's just get right into the reason for the call. You are publishing the second edition of your book, War is a Lie. I find that very interesting, I think the boldness and courage to present that statement to the people, especially of the United States of America. So tell us a little bit about the book and why the second edition.
Well, you know, it's still a lie. Everything they tell us about war is still a lie. Back when I put out the first edition, President Obama was new and people were still, quote unquote, giving him a chance, you know, as they got right into the habit of doing and never stopped. Obama and the Pentagon are putting $65 million into a campaign to beautify the war on Vietnam and celebrate it and commemorate it.
Right.
Obama has declared the Korean War a victory after so many decades of everyone lamenting and denouncing it as a pointless escapade. It's now a success. They're building a new World War I monument in Washington, D.C. I mean, they've run out of wars that people cheer for to take up every inch of space in Washington, D.C., so they're down to World War I to celebrate. And the current president has been bragging about the seven Muslim countries he's been bombing, and the war machine continues to expand. The military expenses are bigger than ever. The Pentagon budget under President Obama has been bigger than under any other president, and it goes on and on with new forms of war. So I wanted to look at sort of how the new wars are sold or done quietly and controversy avoided, and what people are able to resist and not resist, because in 2013 there was a great deal of public pushback on the idea of bombing Syria, which was going to be a massive bombing campaign of Syria, and the public in Europe and in the United States played a big role. And a lot of what you heard was Congress members saying, you know, I don't want to be the jerk who votes for another Iraq, because there'd been a decade of turning Iraq into a badge of shame. And that was very effective and encouraging. But then the next year, you had these videos come out of Americans being beheaded by a brand new evil force that materialized out of nowhere called ISIS.
You know,
never mind that it evolved right out of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which was created by the U.S. invasion of Iraq 10 years earlier. We were supposed to imagine this was more evil than beheadings by our good friends in the Saudi government or the Iraqi government, and we needed to go bomb people and get back into some of these wars. And a lot of people fell for it. You know, I mean, the war in Libya may be the biggest, you know, war disaster created by the Obama administration with a big assist from Hillary Clinton, but it's not something the public fell for. The U.S. public really fell for the ISIS propaganda, and still does, that, you know, this need to do something. And by do something, they mean, you know, bomb somebody. This is the U.S. understanding of do something. But then, you know, just in the past year, upholding the Iran nuclear agreement in the face of demands for a war on Iran was again encouraging. And so in the book, I look at what types of sales pitches for new wars or against diplomatic agreements seem to work and which ones don't and why. Because it's, you know, this is an ongoing project of trying to move the U.S. public to where we recognize war lies quickly and refuse to accept them.
Well, you know, I just want to go back to a couple things that you said. First of all, I can't believe that there wasn't already a World War I monument in Washington, D.C. But the World War II monument to me is disgusting. It's just like such a glorification of the so-called good war.
It is. There is a small Washington, D.C. Veterans or Casualties of World War I monument that I think was declared to be a national one as well, but they want a bigger, better one. It's going to be right next to Freedom Plaza, where we've had some worthwhile anti-war events. But yeah, the World War II monument, you can't avoid it. They stuck it right in the middle of everything. And it's, you know, it's outrageous in part because World War II has been stuck right in the middle of everything in U.S. culture. I mean, it's far and away the leading topic of Hollywood films, television shows, books, art of every nature in U.S. culture. There's no more favorite topic than World War II, and almost entirely the European theater, as they call it, of World War II. It just dominates U.S. culture because it's this sort of root myth of why we should have wars. And for the past three quarters of a century, when you speak against a war, people will acknowledge your argument that there are problems with the war you're discussing, that in fact it's right. Based on a pile of lies, it's immoral, it's mass murder, but World War II was good, and if you oppose war, you must oppose World War II, and therefore you're wrong, and therefore we should support the current war. You know, it makes absolutely no sense, but this has been the dialogue that has happened around debates about every single war since World War II. That's the power that the myths about World War II have over the U.S. imagination.
Well, you know, and it's not only that, but it's the prime justification for the Israeli, you know, apartheid against the Palestinians because of the Holocaust.
Right. Right. And it's incredible to go back and actually look at what happened with World War II, right? World War I was ended in such an irresponsible fashion that numerous prominent public figures immediately predicted World War II, some of them very accurately in terms of the date it would arrive, and for exactly the reasons that that encouraged it. That is the bitterness and vengeance coming out of Germany as a result of the closure of World War I in a manner that punished the entire German people rather than the war makers. And so you saw World War II coming, and the United States spent decades investing in Nazi Germany. U.S. Investments in Nazi Germany increased dramatically compared to anywhere else in the world. It was seen by Britain and by the United States as preferable to the evil communists in the Soviet Union and worth supporting. And you saw armaments increase. You had the biggest peace movement we've ever known in the 20s and the 30s, and you had the Kellogg-Briand Pact ban war, and at the same time you had the arms race escalating, everybody arming for World War II. And you had World War II come about very predictably and very avoidably in Europe. And then you had the United States, desperate to get into it, do everything it could for years to provoke Japan, and to the extent of arming and training pilots in China and supplying airplanes to China and sanctioning and cutting off basic supplies of gas and steel to Japan, to the point where one of the judges at the post-World War II tribunal in Tokyo concluded that the United States had provoked the war, which it very consciously and deliberately did. I mean, it's down in writing. It's not any sort of dispute that the United States sought to provoke a Japanese attack and did so, and then immediately jumped into the war against Japan and in Europe as well, with Germany declaring war on the United States. And during all of these years, it was known what was happening with the Jews in Germany, and the story was downplayed, it was buried, and the government in Washington, led by President Roosevelt, refused to accept Jewish refugees. His wife wanted to, numerous Congress members wanted to, there were families by the thousands volunteering to accept Jewish children into their homes, but Roosevelt wouldn't allow it, the State Department wouldn't allow it, the government wouldn't do it, and the majority of the U.S. public, in a very bigoted way, was against it. And so you then had a war in which not a single poster was about saving the Jews. You know, it was all about the German monsters, you know, and nothing done. And peace advocates demanding that the war be ended to save the Jews, not heeded. And the war escalated repeatedly by the United States in particular into new heights of all-out war on civilians, ultimately in Japan, culminating in the dropping of nuclear bombs on cities. This was a war that transformed war into something that killed primarily civilians in new horrific ways and with new speed and massive numbers. I mean, this is the worst single thing that's happened on the earth that the human race has done to itself, World War II. And we're supposed to believe that it somehow justifies the next three quarters of a century of, you know, war being the primary investment of the U.S. government. It's insanity.
Well, and so you made some great points there. And now, if you oppose World War II, then you must be anti-Semitic because, 6 million Jews were killed during World War II. But you just pointed out that the U.S. was not involved in World War II to save the Jewish people from extermination. And, in fact, Hitler wouldn't have been able to do anything like that without the cover of war.
Indeed, it was the results of World War I and the ongoing hostilities and armaments that led to Nazism. It was the outbreak of war and the escalation of war and the scapegoating of the Jews that resulted in the Holocaust. It was the refusal of Western states to allow insane but preferable mass expulsion of the Jews to anywhere else, the refusal to accept Jewish refugees, the blockading of Germany that resulted in the Nazi determination to kill them rather than expel them. None of which, of course, takes an ounce of blame away from the Nazis who did it.
Right, absolutely.
But this is the insane response you'll get to this radio show. If you blame the United States for something that Germany did, then you're somehow exculpating Germany because you have to pick who to blame. You know, blame doesn't work that way. There's infinite blame to be spread around, and the Nazis deserve every bit of blame for everything they did. So do the Japanese. But the United States deserves an enormous amount of blame for having contributed to those crises and exacerbated them and failed to to ameliorate them, and the peace advocates who were warning about U.S. hostility toward Japan for many years leading up to World War II, and were warning about German treatment of Jews and the need to stop supporting the Nazis for years leading up to the war, and demanding that the war be settled rather than once again an all-out victory and complete surrender, they weren't listened to, but they would have saved many, many lives. Yes, in the end, the United States winning the war liberated Jews who were in the camps, but there would not have been as many Jews in those camps or dead, already murdered in those camps, had there been wiser foreign policy for months and years and decades before.
Well, you know, I should point out, I don't think it's a matter of, you know, the powers that be, they're not wise if they get into war. War is, I'm not going to say it's inevitable, but it's their go-to thing for every problem in the world. And so this brings us to another so-called good war, that if you don't agree with it, then you must be a racist, you must hate black people, and you must be pro-slavery if you disagree with the Civil War. And, you know, I point out to many people when I talk about this, because it's so amazing, David, that when you talk about peace, you're the one that gets put on the defensive, right?
Yep.
And so it's, to me, many people in this country believe that any war the United States has got into is a good war. Bad things might have been done, but that's the exception, not the rule. And so, but there's some people you talked about who maybe pick and choose what wars are good and what wars are bad. And almost universally, the Civil War is considered a good war. And I point out to people that many countries had slavery. They had black slavery or other kinds of slavery. But they got rid of it without killing almost 700,000 people. And why is war and killing the solution to something that killed and mistreated and tortured so many people? And was it really about slavery anyway? You know, when you get down to it, was the Civil War really fought to free the slaves? And so what's the feedback you get about that, and what's your take on that?
Well, I think you made one very important point, that numerous other nations ended slavery without a civil war. So it's not that you were required to have a civil war before you're allowed to end slavery, any more than we're required to have a civil war and slaughter each other's children in fields across the United States now before we can decide to end mass incarceration or end the use of fossil fuels or some other change. I mean, it's just insanity that you have to do the right one first. Also, I think it's worth pointing out that it didn't end slavery, that slavery continued in the South right up to World War II, which, by the way, got the name the Good War during the war on Vietnam, and the Civil War acquired the sort of the same name. The Civil War was something that had always been both loved and hated since it ended by people who knew the horror of it, and certainly slavery was the issue that divided the nation, but the United States government following the Civil War did not end slavery, and slavery continued under other names in the South for decades to come, and when you could arrest a black man for nothing and put him in endless debt to pay court fees and so forth, and force him to go work in a mine in an endless cycle of never escaping the debt, and be treated worse in many cases than were slaves before the Civil War, you haven't solved the problem. I mean, it took a nonviolent civil rights movement 100 years later to really put a dent in the systematic cruelty toward African Americans in the southern United States and elsewhere.
Well, as a matter of fact, the prison industrial complex has become the new slavery. Where the incarcerated, which are, you know, who are mostly people of color, are being paid, just a few cents a day to slave away for, you know, the war machine or other U.S. corporations.
Yeah, the problem of racism and ill treatment of black people in the United States has not gone away. And the bitterness that the Civil War left behind may be part of that. You see the police killings and the police discrimination against African Americans disproportionately in the prisons, disproportionately blocked from voting by the label of felon. And you look at countries that solved somewhat similar problems of slavery without the killing of 750,000 people, and you see less bitterness and more progress toward resolution. In Washington, D.C., Lincoln was able to end slavery, as other nations did, with compensated emancipation, that is, paying compensation to the slave owners who lost their property when freeing the slaves, which of course seems crazy. You should be paying the compensation to the people who were enslaved, but as a preferable solution to a civil war, I think it has much to be admired. And of course, the slave owners in the southern states wouldn't do it. There was no sum of money they would take. They were going to have slavery or die. But the North in the United States did not have to kill 750,000 people for the name of Union, which is what the Civil War was fought for much of the Civil War, up through Gettysburg and beyond. It was not for ending slavery so much as for preserving the Union. And it got to a point where people really couldn't keep killing and dying for that. Who needs this? Who needs a Union at this cost? Let the South go. If the South had been allowed to go without a war, you would have avoided the death and injury and trauma and destruction and suffering and bitterness and burned cities, and you would not have had the fugitive slave law. I mean, slaves who escaped to the North would have escaped, period. And the economic pressures and the social pressures and the international sanctions would almost certainly have put an end to slavery, really truly put an end to slavery, more quickly than it was ended in the United States, had the nation split apart. And we would have two smaller nations and much better ability to influence our government than we have over this oversized giant of a nation that we call the United States.
We could have, like, six nations right now. California could be a republic still. Texas, anyway. And you're right. And people, you know, you've been to Europe. You've been involved in their peace movements over there, you know, what they're doing. And it just is amazing that they do have more influence over their governments because they are smaller. They're closer to them. If I want to go have influence on my federal government, I have to fly 3,500 miles or ride my bike like I did that one time.
Yeah.
So it's just, you know, I think it has become just too gargantuan. The bureaucracies are so entrenched. And the momentum is, like I said earlier, towards war. It's not towards figuring out, how can we, like, solve problems without murdering, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. There's no momentum for that. How do we create that, David?
Well, I'm working on this project called World Beyond War, and the website is worldbeyondwar.org, and we're trying to bring together people who want to move the conversation in that direction toward ending the whole institution of war. And people have signed on and been volunteering and getting involved in 133 countries so far. which is not at the level of the Pentagon, which thanks the troops for watching football games in 175 countries, but it is growing, and it is encouraging, and it is helping to move some of the other peace groups and activists, I think, to some degree, toward talking about each step as a step toward ending war, not as is often done, you know, let's avoid this war to keep the military better prepared for better wars, or, you know, let's avoid this weapon that doesn't really work, you know, I want to avoid the weapons that do really work. And so it's starting to talk about it differently, and we're planning a big conference in Washington, D.C. in September that we'll be announcing very soon, and would love it if you, Cindy, and everyone in California is able to come and take part. But it is very far away. It's, you know, imagine they're about to have the Democratic Party primary in Guam, right? Imagine somebody in Guam trying to influence the U.S. government. It's a colony, and it's an empire, and it's an empire that seems intent on dominating the entire globe, and caring less and less what any of us have to say about its activities. So when we do see successes, when we see the people of Okinawa working with the people of the United States and stopping, at least for the moment, plans to build another new U.S. military base in Okinawa, you know, we have to celebrate that and encourage them and make it stick and shame the U.S. government that wants to insist on putting that base in. When we hold up a nuclear agreement with Iran, we have to make sure that lasts through the next year and the next year and the next year, against the efforts of the warmongers to strip it away and launch a war on Iran. But we also have to make it last without lying about it, because this was an agreement put through with one side saying we can't have an agreement with Iran, they're building nukes and want to kill us, and the other side saying we must have this agreement with Iran because they're building nukes and want to kill us, which is not true. And they're not, they weren't building nukes, and they don't want to kill us. And so you have the U.S. public in a worse place now regarding Iran than before the debate and the agreement. So we have to recognize the importance of history and education. You know, there's a reason why a government that wants to control all of Asia is putting millions of dollars into celebrating the war on Vietnam. They understand that if people accept lies about the past, then they will accept lies about the future. And if people start to accept all of these past wars as having been good and noble, or at least tolerable, well, then, you know, they're going to accept more wars and assume that we can't get by without wars. This is what we've come to with drone wars, where we've given presidents, and the next president, whether he's on the team you like or the team you hate, is going to have the power to murder anyone by the hundreds now. They just claim to have killed 150 people in Somalia. In the same weekend that they premiered this movie in D.C., Cindy, called Eye in the Sky, with these great actors like Helen Mirren, that creates this fantasy, right, where they have these terrorists, including a white person, so it's not racist, go into this neighborhood in Somalia that's completely controlled by the terrorists, so you can't get at them and can't capture them, you can only kill them. And then they get a little camera on a drone the size of a bug to go in the house and see them strapping on suicide vests and preparing to go out and kill thousands of people in 10 minutes from now. And then they decide to have a drone strike, right? And so the drone strike is to prevent an actual imminent threat, not, you know, just the words imminent threat, and to save more lives than you're killing, and to kill people who've actually been identified and can't possibly be captured. And the director of this movie was at the premiere and flew a little drone around the theater and said, "See? It's all true." I raised my hand and got the first question in and said, "Look, we know that most of these people dying are innocent. Most of them are not identified. Many of them could easily have been captured. And in no case has there been an actual imminent threat as you fantasize in this movie. Isn't that true? And he said, yes, that's true. But this could happen. You could imagine this could happen. This is their propaganda. This is like right. The ticking time bomb for torture, or the reincarnation of Hitler for, you know, a war as a whole. This is the story they're going to be telling us now, is we have to have the drone program to do what happened in that movie, Eye in the Sky. But it's nonsense. It doesn't really happen. And the same weekend, they killed 150 people in a drone attack, another missile attack. And by no means did they identify them. By no means were they about to go kill a greater number of people or any such nonsense. And they've redefined imminent threat actually to mean nothing at all, and militant to mean military age male, which in that case probably meant 12 years old. You know, and people don't know anything. I mean, this is why.
Hollywood has long time been the propaganda arm of the Pentagon,
yeah.
Or one of the propaganda arms of. I read your piece about that. It was really good. I'll link it with the blog that comes out with this. It's just like absolutely disgusting. You know, they were going to make a movie about me, Hollywood, a Hollywood movie. Long time, you know, we talked about it for several years. And then they just sort of said, you know what, anti-war films don't sell. We can't do it.
Yeah, I had a great movie maker was going to make a documentary of War is a Lie when the first edition came out. No money. There was no, this was somebody who easily got money for projects, couldn't get any for this. You know, and this drone movie director openly bragged about having military advisors on the film, right? And had a general sitting next to him, you know.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's like Zero Dark Thirty was, you know, advised by the CIA. The Interview was, you know, advised by the State Department. This is state propaganda, except that it's not called state propaganda, and nobody knows it, and nobody, you know, seems to have an understanding of the facts. I mean, it takes like 10 years of raising hell for people to know that a war like the war in Iraq was based on lies, and then they start to forget it. You know, so,
right.
So this is
well,
why we have
you know,
to
then
keep
you get a
up.
Democratic president, and if he's going to drone bomb people and send troops in, then, you know, there must be a good reason for it. And, you know, that's one of our problems, one of the obstacles we have to surmount all the time. Well, David, I'm very excited because you're going on book tour for War is a Lie, and you're coming. I'm going to be involved with you in Northern California, and we're going to go to several different stops to talk about not just your book, but, you know, how war is actually a lie, and I think it's going to be great. So tell my listeners where they can find more information about. In Northern California, it'll be we'll be together like May 29th and 30th.
Oh, I can't. I can't keep it
well,
straight.
Well, I know,
but
we'll be in Oakland on the 29th and San Francisco or Berkeley, I think, because that's Casey's birthday. And as soon as I was asked, I was like, yeah, I always try to do something like that on Casey's birthday. So I know for sure we'll be, you know, somewhere together on that day.
It'll be Casey's birthday and it'll be Memorial Day weekend, and we'll be memorializing peace instead of war. But people can go, the name of the book is War is a Lie, and if you go to warisalie.org, you can find all the info about the book and the events. And the book is being published on April 5th, and I would love it if everyone went to Amazon if you're so inclined, or if you prefer, go to your local bookstore and support them. But if you are someone who buys books online, everybody buy it online that day, April 5th, and knock whatever warmongering tome is there off the top of the list at Amazon, which always helps. Amazon itself is part of the military-industrial complex working for the CIA. But we will be in San Francisco and Oakland and down to Fresno, and I'll be everywhere else around the country. So warisalie.org has the schedule.
Okay, David Swanson, is there anything else you'd like to add? before we say goodbye.
Thanks for everything you're doing, Cindy, and I'm looking forward to seeing you. It's been a while, and I'll see you in a couple months.
Well, I know we used to like seem to see each other a couple times a month back in the day when people actually cared about these wars, and we had a little bit better funding so we can make these things possible. But yeah, looking forward to
President Trump. You know, there's going to be a huge peace movement if there's a Republican president.
Oh, absolutely, and you know, I hate to say something like that, but you know, another 8 years of a Democrat. I don't know. I just wish people could stand on their principles no matter who was infesting the Oval Office.
Well, I do too, although I prefer Bernie to Hillary, and if you want to go vote in primaries, go vote for Bernie, for goodness sakes, but don't expect an election to save us. We need a peace movement no matter who ends up in the White House.
But God, Bernie would be just the same. You know, he'd be another imperialist. And we'd have another immobilization of movements because the first thing you would hear is give them a chance. And, you know, after 8 years of giving Obama a chance, we're just in much deeper crap than we were, you know, in 2009. So, if elections can solve things, which they can't.
It would be very, very hard. It would be very hard to mobilize people under President Bernie Sanders. They would refuse to believe in his flaws. That being said, he is not as bad as Obama or Hillary. He, you know, on a global comparison, you know, compare him to leaders of other civilized nations. He's a crazy militarist, but compare him to Hillary Clinton, and you know, it's the age of peace and harmony. I mean, they're not identical.
We got to get over the lesser of two evils or the evil of two lessers. You know, it just is. But Trump, now, maybe if we had Trump, maybe we'd start getting more donations.
Oh, there would be 10 times.
That's such a cynical, selfish thing to say.
Well, I'm not saying I'm in favor of President Trump, but just as a factual observation or forecast, if you had a Republican president, everything the peace movement did would be 10 times bigger immediately, no question. And that would be a good thing. Whether the net result would be good or bad is a different question.
Right, exactly. Okay, David Swanson, well, thank you for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. And this was an excellent conversation. And like we said, see you soon.
Thanks, Cindy.
Okay, bye-bye.
Well, that's the Soapbox for this week. As always, I hope you were informed and inspired to further action and to get further information. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar. I'd like to thank David Swanson for his principled and continuing work for peace. And I'd like to thank you for listening to and supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out for now.